welcome.
Shalom, this is Phil Chernofsky, and I'd like you to join me in another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. It is Yom Chamishi B'Shabbat, Yud Bet L'Chodesh Sivan HaTavshin Samach Vav, Thursday, the 12th of the month of Sivan, 5766, Thursday, June 8th. This issue of Torah Tidbits is for Parshat. Well, that depends where you live. If you live in Israel, it's Parshat Beha'alotcha. If you live in Chutz Laaretz, outside of Israel, it's Parshat Naso. The Parsha that we will focus on is Beha'alotcha, because the show originates at the Israel Center, the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. We can technically apply, at least to the Torah portion of the show, the rule, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah Udvar Hashem Mirushalayim, that Torah comes from Zion and the Word of God from Jerusalem. We will focus on the Parshat HaShavua according to Israel. I will explain why we are out of sync for a number of weeks. But first, let's do Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130. Shir ha-ma'alot, mima'amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shimavakoli, tihiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Imavonot tishmorya Adonai miya amod, ki imacha haslicha lama'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro ho'cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mishomerim la'boker, shomerim la'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzora uvashivya, ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afila l'ora u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman koriv, Vinomar Amen. Okay, an explanation. Those who know this already, I apologize, but it's important for those who might not be aware of it. Let's go back a week to the holiday of Shavuot. According to the Torah, Shavuot is a single day. The day following 49 days, following 7 full weeks, from the beginning of the counting of the Omer, which was the day following the first day of Pesach. The 50th day of the Omer, which we don't count, is the holiday of Shavuot. Shavuot corresponds to the 6th of Sivan, even though the Torah never gives a date for it, because it really does not depend on a date. It depends on being the day following the counting of the Omer. Now, in fact, when we have a Sanhedrin, and months are sanctified and proclaimed based on eyewitness testimony to the first visibility of the lunar crescent, it is possible that any given month can have 29 days or 30 days. So from Pesach, when you've got Pesach with 30 and Iyar with 29 in our fixed calendar, if both would be 30, or both would be 29, it would change the date of Shavuot. The one thing that it would not change is the fact that Shavuot is the 50th day of the Omer, the uncounted 50th day. In the land of Israel, the holiday is celebrated as a single day. Outside of Israel, there's a long-standing tradition to celebrate it as 2 days. I don't know if you want the full explanation for that, but it dates back to the time when each month, as I mentioned before, could have been 29 or 30 days, which meant that the population of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael and in the nearby areas of outside of Israel needed to be notified each month when Rosh Chodesh, the first of the month, was proclaimed and sanctified. With the knowledge of what day was Rosh Chodesh Nisan, for example, a person, a community, is able to determine which day is Passover, Pesach. Without that information, there would be a doubt as to whether it is one day or the next, depending upon whether the previous month had 29 or 30 days. In our fixed calendar, we know this in advance, but we're not up to there yet. In the time of Sanhedrin, before a community was notified when Rosh Chodesh was, they would be duty-bound to plan on observing each holiday as 2 days to cover the doubt as to which day is the real date, so that the prohibition of milacha, creative activities, whatever is forbidden, whatever is required on Yom Tov would be observed on the genuine day, even if we're not sure which it is. When there was no more Sanhedrin and sanctification of the new moon according to that system, the calendar was constructed based upon the authority of a Sanhedrin to fix the number of days and have certain conditions by which it will be known in advance every given month how many days it has. So technically it would not be necessary to observe 2 days Yom Tov in order to be observing it on the actual day, because anywhere in the world a Jew and a Jewish community will know when the real day of Yom Tov is. However, a combination of other factors worked towards maintaining Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyot, the second day of the festival in exile, and that's a very purposeful term. A, because we do not have the halachic authority to stop with 2 days in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, and B, there is a notion that not being in Israel, not being in Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, it is more difficult to reach a certain spirituality on a holiday, and therefore you could almost say that 2 days of observance would be necessary. You're dealing with an inefficient machine, so to speak, and in order for it to yield 1 day's worth of sanctity, it needs to churn away at it for 2 days, just in a figure of speech, an analogy. Here's another thing to add to the pot. Even if there is such a thing as 2 days for Sukkot and Shmini Atzeret Simchat Torah and the first day of Pesach and the last day of Pesach, there technically should only be 1 day for Shavuot anyway, because Shavuot is not dependent upon when the Sanhedrin proclaimed Rosh Chodesh Sivan. We don't care. And it's not even dependent on Rosh Chodesh Iyar. It is dependent on the proclamation of more than 2 months before the sanctification of a particular day as the first day of the month of Nisan. That fixed Pesach, which fixed the starting of the counting of the Omer, and that fixes Shavuot as the 50th day. So even if you want to argue that a community outside of Israel would not know which day was proclaimed as Rosh Chodesh for a week, for 2 weeks or more, thereby necessitating Yom Tov Sheni, when it came to Shavuot, it should have been very common to already know when Shavuot is and observe only a single day. For this, the sages applied a rule of thumb, which is not absolute, but it's quite strong, called lo plug. Let's not distinguish between one festival and another. If the rule is that in the diaspora you have 2 days Yom Tov, then that will apply to Shavuot as well. All of this has been introduction to a point I haven't gotten to yet, but let's add one more piece of background. Rosh Hashanah is universally 2 days, even in Eretz Yisrael, even in the land of Israel, and that's because it begins at the very beginning of the month, and there would be no time at all to know in advance when Rosh Chodesh Tishrei would be, and therefore it evolved very quickly that it worked out best to observe Rosh Hashanah as 2 days, which are really considered as one long day. Technically, Yom Kippur should also be 2 days, but our sages did not want to burden the individual with having to fast for 48, 49 hours. It's a task that no human being should have imposed on him, and therefore they said, even though in theory we have that same technical old-time doubt as to which day was Yom Kippur, it doesn't matter, you only fast for 1 day. Now, with Shavuot last Friday, outside of Israel it was observed on Friday and Shabbat. And that's where the problem comes from. We, in Israel, celebrated Shavuot on Friday, and Shabbat was a regular Shabbat, with its own Parshat HaShavua, and what we were up to last week was Parshat Naso, and this week Baha'alotcha, etc., etc. Outside of Israel, Parshat HaShavua was suspended and replaced by the special reading for the second day of Shavuot. We don't have that here. But outside of Israel, there is a Torah reading for the second day of Shavuot, and it was done. And Parshat HaShavua was put on hold for a week. Now we come to this coming Shabbat. This coming Shabbat in Israel is Shabbat Parshat Beha'alotcha. In Chutz La'aretz, it's Parshat Naso. We in Israel are going to be one Parshat HaShavua, one weekly Torah portion ahead of the diaspora. Or if you want to look at it the other way, the diaspora will be one Parshat HaShavua behind Eretz Yisrael. This is not the worst kind of situation. It is awkward, and occasionally there are very frustrating consequences of it. I think the prime example of that is a boy living in the States approaching his bar mitzvah, and he knows that his bar mitzvah sedra is Naso, and he practices it, all 179 psukim of it, and he's raring to go. And his family says, Tatala, we have a surprise for you. We are going to celebrate your bar mitzvah in the land of Israel. Excitement, joy, hectic preparations for the trip. They get here, they check into the hotel. It's a Thursday night. Friday comes, Shabbat comes, they have their meals in the hotel or wherever. Maybe the Israel Center with its wonderful caterer. And Shabbat morning, they arranged for the bar mitzvah boy to read the Torah in the local synagogue. And he opens up the Torah to Parshat Naso, and the Gabbai, standing by the side of the Torah, rolls the Torah forward to Parshat Beha'alotcha, and points to him that this is where he should read. He says, no, I don't know this. I know Parshat Naso. That's my bar mitzvah sedra. That's what I studied. The Gabbai says, well, we read that last week. Believe it or not, this happens. There are ways to make the experience less traumatic for the kid. We won't go into that now. Fact. we are one parsha off between Israel and outside of Israel. This situation will continue starting last week to this week for a total of 6 weeks, where we will read different Torah readings until that sixth week, when we in Israel are up to Parshat Balak, and in Chutz La'aretz they're only up to Parshat Chukat, so they combine Chukat and Balak, read them together, we don't, and now they caught up. Or now we separated Chukat and Balak and allowed the Jews of the diaspora to catch up with us. One way you look at it or another, the following Shabbat, which will be in mid-July, is Parshat Pinchas all over the world. Until then, there are 6 Shabbatot that we are off. For Pirkei Avot, we remain off almost the whole period of time till a couple of weeks before Rosh Hashanah. And what we will do, as we do in the printed version and the electronic version of Torah Tidbits, we do the Parsha as it is in Israel. We will do that for Torah Tidbits audio as well. And if you want to come back to this Parsha, if you're listening to this outside of Israel, and you don't want to listen to it now, but you'd rather listen to it a week from now, you'll be able to feel as if it is Parshat Be'alotcha that I'm talking about coming up for you that very Shabbat. Your choice. Speaking of Shavuot, which we were, there is a song which is taken from the Piyut, the liturgical poetry of the second day of Shavuot, which we were speaking about as well. It became a very popular song, Shiru LaMelech. Listen to part of a track. It's a medley. I'll pull out just this song from an album called Earth and Sky, Eretz V'Shamayim, by Kashti Levi, or Levi Kashti, or who knows how to pronounce it, but that's the performer, and the song Shiru LaMelech. album Eretz V'Shamayim has a lot of Ashkenazi music, but it also has Sephardi and it has Teimani, Yemenite. Maybe I'll play one of those tracks or part of a track later just to give you a flavor of the other kind of music, or the kinds of music. For all I said until now, the fact of the matter is that Baha'alotcha, which we're reading, and Naso, which is being read in Chutz La'aretz, are really connected, especially in the context of the last part of Naso, the beginning of Baha'alotcha, which make up the Torah reading of Chanukah, and there is a significant dovetailing from Naso into Baha'alotcha. Let's do, or at least start, an overview of Baha'alotcha. The first portion, the famous one, which is the Torah reading that finishes the Chanukah portion, is about Aharon lighting of the menorah, being in charge of lighting of the menorah. A very significant factor here is we've already had the command to tend the menorah, to light the menorah, that the menorah should be in a certain position in the main sanctuary of the Mikdash, and it is almost totally unnecessary to go through it again. God says to Moshe, speak to Aaron, tell him that when you light the lamps of the menorah, they should shine towards the central stalk. Aaron did what he was told. El mul pnei ha-menorah he'ala neiroteha. He had the wicks facing the center as God commanded Moshe. And then it adds something that we've already had even in more detail. This is how you make the menorah, hammered from a single piece of gold all the way through. As God showed Moshe, so they did. Because the Torah needn't have said this here, but it did, we have to get something out of it. We have to understand why it's here. It's hard enough sometimes to understand why something that needs to be there is there. But here, we're even asking why something that technically doesn't have to be here, it's a repeat, why is it here? And the answer is given by the Ramban and other commentaries that the immediately previous chapter, which was that very, very long, longest one in the whole Torah, 89 verses, that dealt with the dedication of the Mishkan by the gifts of each tribal leader. And here's Aharon, who is the tribal leader, technically, of all of Shevet Levi, and he does not have the material wealth to give gifts either exactly the same or on the level of that of the tribal leaders. And he felt bad. Our commentaries teach us that's why this is here. Aharon's daily service in the temple, the Kohen Gadol, the Kohanim, their service in the Mikdash is their commitment. That's their gift. And that gift is as precious or even more precious than any of the lavish gifts that the Nisim gave. Ramban and others see this on another level, that talking about a Kohen Gadol lighting the menorah of the Mikdash is reminiscent of what happened centuries later when the Chashmonaim rededicated the Beit HaMikdash and lit the menorah, Chanukah. We have here the classic, or one of the classic, remez to Chanukah from the Torah. And as such, there are connections that can't be avoided. The Haftorah of Baha'alotcha is the same as the Haftorah of Shabbos Chanukah. The Torah reading for Chanukah every day comes from the end of Naso and the beginning of Baha'alotcha. Zot Chanukat HaMizbeach. This is the dedication, or, in the case of Chanukah, the rededication of the altar and of the Beit HaMikdash. Following this portion, we have the command to take the tribe of Levi, to set them up as the functionaries in the temple, in the Mikdash, auxiliary functions to those of the Kohen, in lieu of the firstborns of all of the tribes that originally apparently were slated to do those tasks in the Mikdash. That sort of brings us to the portion of the first annual observance of Pesach, Korban Pesach, followed by the topic of Pesach Sheni. But first, let's hear another track from Eretz V'Shamayim, Earth and Sky, this one with a distinctively Temani flavor.
Shomayim wehelom omadim la'asad rasad ganom washir yabiyom aras wa shomayim wehelom omadim la'asad rasad ganom washir yabiyom
Son, almost a full year out of Egypt, that God says to Moshe, time to tell the people that they are about to observe the first annual anniversary of Yetziat Mitzrayim by bringing Korban Pesach. Their memories were from the year before, which was similar but different. In other words, Pesach Mitzrayim had certain things which were never again done. The business of putting a splotch of blood from the Korban Pesach on the doorposts and the lintel. One-shot deal. The business of taking the lamb into your home for 4 days before. One-shot deal. The business of being fully dressed with belt tied and bag packed and in order to eat it was a one-shot deal. However, many of the details are in perpetuity. In other words, the eating it all up that night and not leaving over any for the morning, the not breaking a bone in the Korban Pesach, the rule of eating it together with one group of people and not switching from place to place. These, eating it with matzah, of course, and maror, these things were for Korban Pesach forever. So it really makes a lot of sense for the Torah to say, we're coming up to the first real Korban Pesach after the original one. This is the one that you're going to have to do every year. And God tells Moshe to tell the people and review with them how to do it. Then the Torah says, and they did it. We celebrated the first annual Pesach. Now, one negative note that comes in already is the fact that here in chapter 9, Perek Tet, it says it was the first of Nisan in the second year out of Egypt. The book of Bamidbar begins in the second year out of Egypt, the first of Iyar. God said to Moshe, count the people. That came later. Again, the book of Bamidbar begins 1 month after God's command to remind the people to bring Korban Pesach, and 2 weeks after the actual Korban Pesach. So events in chapter 9, Perek Tet, are earlier than the very beginning, Perek Aleph of Bamidbar. Rashi catches that, and he says, first of all, there's a well-known principle, Ein Seder Mukdam Umuchar BaTorah. There is no guarantee that the Torah is going to be presented in chronological order. Sometimes an event is out of place in time. Of course, I'm adding the of course, I think it's implied by the way it's treated. Of course, there has to be a reason. If there's no reason to put things out of order, why put them out of order? Just let the Torah continue chronologically. So every time there is something out of chronological order, we are entitled to say, why? Why tell us about an event that occurred a month earlier, 8 chapters later? Why start with something that happened after something else in the Midbar? And the answer is, by Rashi, that the events of the Korban Pesach, as wonderful as they are and as special as they are, and what came from them, are a little bit embarrassing, because I said this was the first annual observance of the Korban Pesach. In fact, they did not do another Korban Pesach the entire time they were wandering about the Midbar. They should have been doing one every single year, because that's what the Torah says. This one, the one in Mitzrayim, of course they did when they got out, or when they were almost getting out. This is the first annual one they did, but for the rest of the 40 years, they did not bring Korban Pesach, because they weren't allowed to bring Korban Pesach, because they had uncircumcised males in their household, because they didn't circumcise them. Question, why? Why? And the answer was, which is also contained in this week's Sedra, they had no advanced warning when they would be traveling. They camped. They could be camping for the afternoon and traveling the next morning. They could be camping for a day, 2 days, a week, a month, a year, or 25 years. They never had a way of knowing when the cloud that stayed over the Mishkan lifted and they heard the blowing of the Chatzotzrot, which is also in this week's Seder, the silver trumpets. They had to pack and get ready to move. Traveling with a recently circumcised baby is dangerous. And therefore, they used halachic permission not to circumcise, because they never knew when they'd be traveling. The result of that was an entire generation of uncircumcised kids, people, adults also. And that's a little bit upsetting, because here is the new nation of Israel. They have two very, very special mitzvot that identify this nationhood. One is circumcision and one is Korban Pesach. They didn't do the one, so they couldn't do the other. And that's embarrassing to the people. Therefore,
by Midbar starts on the second month, Iyar, on the first day, God said to Moshe, count the people. And only later it says, by the way, 1 month before that count, God said to Moshe, tell the people to bring Korban Pesach. 2 weeks later they did it. And then the story continues from there. So you have the command to Moshe to remind the people about Korban Pesach, followed by the episode, not the episode, the account of the people doing what they were commanded to do. Good. But only this 1 year. Followed by the way, the next time after this that Korban Pesach was brought was by Yehoshua and the people after they came into Eretz Yisrael, after he had a mass circumcision of everybody that was uncircumcised, and that was followed by the first Korban Pesach in Eretz Yisrael, and from then it continued. In any event, the Torah tells us, after it tells us that Korban Pesach was brought as commanded, it says there were some people who were tamei, and they weren't able to participate in Korban Pesach, and they came to Moshe complaining about it. They said, Lama Nigara, why should we be excluded? Why should we be not included in this great mitzvah just because we happen to be tamei? No fault of our own. It's a big mitzvah to tend to the dead. There are sources that say that the people who complained were none other than Mishael and El Tzafon, who were two cousins of Moshe, who Moshe called to take care of the bodies of Nadav and Avihu, their cousins, the sons of Aaron, who were killed because Aaron couldn't, because Aaron's other two sons couldn't, and therefore they went to the cousins. So here, Moshe commands them to take care of the dead bodies of Nadav and Avihu. According to one tradition, that was on the eighth day of Nisan. So they became tamei. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 is their seventh day of ritual impurity. That's the day of the bringing of the Korban Pesach. They can become purified and be ready to eat Korban Pesach that night, because it'll be after their period of Tumah. But the Torah says, no, you can't do that. This is like a very sort of an exception to a rule. The exception being that when a person will become tamei that night, he's allowed to eat things that are tahor, that require a state of ritual purity. The one exception is if a person is still tamei on the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan, but will become tahor by the eve of the 15th, he still cannot eat Korban Pesach, because Korban Pesach, the eating, is tied to Korban Pesach, the bringing, which was at a time when he was still tamei. Therefore, they complained, they wanted to participate, and therefore Moshe says, let's hear what God has to say about it. And God had the following to say about it. A person, now or in future generations, who will be tamei, or, the or only applies to future generations, b'derech rechoka, far away from the place of the Mikdash. Definition for our time is, for everything since the Beit HaMikdash is distant from Jerusalem. A person who was tamei or distant from Jerusalem and was not able to bring Korban Pesach on the 14th of Nisan is hereby commanded to bring Korban Pesach on the 14th of Iyar, 1 month later. What we call Pesach Sheni, what the Mishnah calls Pesach Katan, and it's called Pesach Katan because it's not a 7-day holiday, it's not even a 1-day holiday, but it's a 1-day thing, You bring Korban Pesach in the afternoon of the 14th of Iyar, and you eat it that night with matzah and maror. You don't have a seder, you don't sing Hallel when you eat it. You say Hallel when you bring it in the afternoon. And you're allowed to have chametz in your possession, unlike the first. So it's really not a real Pesach, but it's Pesach Katan, a Pesach Aleh, little one. Now, the questions that come from this are many. First and foremost, when you have a time-related mitzvah, let's take as an example Yom Kippur. A person is sick on Yom Kippur and needs to eat and drink. He doesn't come the next day and says, oh, Chaval, why should I miss out on such an important mitzvah like fasting on Yom Kippur when I was sick, I didn't feel well. So he's told, don't worry about it, you were sick, you have halachic permission to eat, you wouldn't even be allowed to fast, you're free from any wrongdoing, it's not a sin, it's a mitzvah to eat, and you daven, and that's all. There is no Yom Kippur for you. If you have a sukkah, and you live in a climate where it rains a lot, and it rained from Erev Sukkot straight through Simchas Torah, every single day, you had no opportunity at all to step foot into the sukkah. That's a big shame, but there's nothing to do about it. You can't say, just because the following week breaks out into Indian summer and it's great weather, okay, I'll eat the sukkah this week. There is no makeup. If you want to talk about a mitzvah that is not dependent on time, of course you could do it late. It has nothing to do with time. I didn't get a chance to give tzedakah when you made an appeal. All right, then give it now. You know, and many other mitzvot that are not related to time. A person who didn't bring bikurim right after Shavuot has until Sukkot or really until the next Hanukkah to bring. But a time-related thing, the Torah goes out of its way to say on the 14th of the first month, Bein Harbayim, in the afternoon, that's the time for Pesach. What did these guys think when they came after that happened and said, it's not fair, we should miss out? They should have been told, you are Tamei, you have a good excuse, you're not held at all culpable for not bringing Korban Pesach. Better luck next year. Instead, they were ke'ilu, as if they were given a gift by God. This gift was not an afterthought. This was built into the original Torah Misinai, that if it happens that you miss Korban Pesach on the 14th of Nisan, you bring Korban Pesach on the 14th of Iyar. Now, is this a makeup for the Korban Pesach that was missed? It would seem so, but it isn't. It is considered to be its own separate command. There's a command in the Torah, actually it's several mitzvot in the Torah, to bring Korban Pesach. And there's a separate command
that if you didn't bring the first Pesach, you are obligated and you have a mitzvah to bring Pesach Sheni. There is a famous question as to whether we view Pesach Sheni as a makeup for Pesach Rishon or as a standalone mitzvah. Of course, standalone is a misnomer because it depends upon whether a person has already fulfilled Pesach Rishon. If someone participated in Pesach Rishon, it was brought on his behalf and he ate from it, or even if it was brought on his behalf and he did not manage to eat from it for whatever reason, he does not have Pesach Sheni to bring. It's not for him. But, on the other way of looking at it, Pesach Sheni is its own set of mitzvot. First of all, we count them among 613, and that says something. In other words, if Pesach Sheni would to be just viewed as a detail of Pesach Rishon, we would not count the command to bring Pesach Sheni among the 613 mitzvot. The mitzvah would be bring Pesach Rishon, and part of that mitzvah would be if you didn't bring Pesach Rishon, then you have to bring Pesach Sheni. But since Chazal, who count mitzvot, our sages who gave numbers to these mitzvot, numbered among the 613 mitzvot in the Torah, the command to bring Korban Pesach, the requirement to eat Korban Pesach, together with matzah and moror, the prohibition of breaking a bone in Korban Pesach Sheni, the prohibition of leaving over Pesach Sheni till morning, these are all counted among 613, then it seems, at least from that way of looking at it, that we're considering it a separate mitzvah. The analogy that I like to give, which is a weak one, I would say, but still it says, oh, okay, you can understand it, is to a test in school, major test, midterm exam. A student missed it. Comes the next day and says, I really, really, really would like to take that exam. I know how important it was, and I know the material, I know its significance on my final grade, and I know that my classwork hasn't been so great, so if you grade me without the midterm exam, I'm in trouble. Whatever. A teacher could say to him, okay, I'll give you the midterm exam, or could say, look, that was yesterday. After the exam, I gave the answers to the students, we spoke about it, and it wouldn't be fair for you to take that test. That test was only for yesterday, and once you miss that, even with this fine doctor's note that explains why you couldn't be here, it's gone. However, I will be nice to you and offer you a different test that I will count in lieu of the test that you missed. That's sort of like what Pesach Sheni is. Anyone who took yesterday's test but would like to also take it again cannot. It's not for them. This test is only for people who missed the first test. And here you could add to the analogy, is it with valid excuse or not? So a teacher could say, if you have a doctor's note for missing the midterm, I will give you a second midterm. Or he could say, even if you don't, even if you skipped school because you were chicken to take the test, I'll give you the opportunity. When it comes to Pesach Sheni, interestingly, it is anybody who missed Pesach Rishon is entitled to do Pesach Sheni, is commanded to do Pesach Sheni, has a mitzvah to do Pesach Sheni. That includes the Torah's two official excuses, Tomei, ritually impure, or Derech Rechoka, at a distance from the place of the bringing of the Korban Pesach. We'll leave that purposely vague. The issue of ritual impurity is not vague at all. It's very specific and detailed. Derech Rechoka is a little fuzzier. But let's say a person lived right around the corner from the Temple Mount. And let's say the person was perfectly tahor, ritually pure, but he forgot. He had a hangover from the night before, and he slept through the afternoon. He was sick. He broke a leg. He couldn't find a lamb. He found a lamb, and it turned out to be female, and it wasn't eligible for Korban Pesach. Or intentionally, willfully, spitefully refusing to have anything to do with Korban Pesach, all of the above have a command to bring Pesach Sheni. The guy that intentionally skipped Pesach Rishon certainly has to take advantage of this opportunity. He'd got to be really a wicked person or a fool to not take advantage of it. But that's the way it works. In any event, another indication that it's a standalone mitzvah is the fact that a convert to Judaism who converts after Yud Dalet, 14th of Nisan, but before the 14th of Iyar, is eligible to bring Pesach Sheni. If it were purely a makeup for Pesach Rishon, we would shrug our shoulders and tell the guy, true, you're Jewish now, you weren't Jewish then, so that's irrelevant to you. It has no meaning for you to bring Pesach Sheni because it's a makeup for a Korban which you weren't involved in, because a non-Jew can't eat Korban Pesach. On the other hand, the halacha seems to be that we allow the ger, the convert, the new convert, to bring Pesach Sheni. And that means it has a nature of its own, an independent kind of status. The other illustration, which is one that I take personally because I was born after Pesach Rishon, but before Pesach Sheni, and have a grandson. The difference between us is that my bar mitzvah already was, so this becomes just a study in academics. But for him, Mirtz Hashem, he's 6 plus now, and by the time he's bar mitzvah, we can have a Beit HaMikdash, we can have restoration of Korban Pesach, and this will be halacha lemaaseh for him. And that means someone who was born after the 14th of Nisan, and not before, but yes, before the 14th of Iyar, on the year that he is about to reach the age of mitzvot, Rambam seems to recommend to him that he not participate in the first Pesach. Even though he's been doing it for a number of years, he should stay out of it, which means he comes to the Seder, he has the mitzvah to eat matzah as a child would, he has 4 cups of wine and Haggadah and everything else related to it, but he is not listed as one of the people for whom the Korban Pesach is going to be offered that afternoon of the 14th, nor does he eat from that Korban Pesach, even though he's tahor, ritually pure, and even though he's not distant from Yerushalayim. And when it comes time for Pesach Sheni, he now has reached the age of mitzvot, and he has an obligation as an adult, a halachic adult, to bring Pesach Sheni. So it again speaks for the fact that it is its old mitzvah. Now, if we leave the details aside and look at a concept here, it's very significant. Number one, I mentioned before that Pesach Sheni was part of original Torah Misinai, which means it was not a response to these guys that came to say it's not fair, we were tummy and couldn't participate, and then Moshe said, oh, I don't know what to do with you, let's see what God said. God, so to speak, scratches his head and says, I don't know, I'll tell you what you do. Tell them they can bring Korban Pesach on the 14th of Iyar. It's not like that. That's always been there. But it is presented in the Torah almost like it was a reward for these people who said, why should we miss out on such an important mitzvah? Because logically, as I mentioned before, it doesn't apply to anything else. A time limit is over. It rains the entire week of Sukkot, and the following week is beautiful weather. You have no mitzvah to eat in the sukkah. There's no makeup for that. Better luck next year. That kind of thing, which could have been the response to these people also. But not with Korban Pesach. It's too core, too central to the whole fabric of the Jewish people. Of course, it's a limited extra chance. You can't bring it any time you want. It has to be, if not the 14th of Nisan in the afternoon, then the 14th of Iyar in the afternoon. And that's it. So if you're tome both times, or you forgot both times, or you didn't do it both times for whatever reason, there is no other opportunity. But as such, again, I say leaving the details aside, it says to us there is such a thing as a second chance, even when you didn't think there was a second chance. And especially if it bothers you and you care about it. Again, you can't generalize this and apply it to other things because it just doesn't go. But as a concept, it's good to separate it from its details and make these points. Now, we had a very beautiful piece of Chizuk and Idud, one of the columns in Torah Tidbits, the printed version and the electronic version. This was submitted by Joel Rabibo from Beit El. And he made a beautiful point, which I would like to make as my parting shot for this show. Lama Nigara, these people, could have sat back and said, we were exempt from Korban Pesach, and we'll pick it up next time we do it. There's no need for them to have said, here's a mitzvah and we want to do it. The byword, the catchphrase for this kind of attitude of chaval, we can't do this mitzvah, is lama nigara. And in the Chizuk and Idud piece, Joel Rabibo put it to living in Eretz Yisrael. Even if you want to argue that there is no halachic imperative to live in Israel in our time, or in dangerous times, or in hard economic times, which, by the way, people dispute and say it is an obligation no matter what. But even if you want to claim from your life in the diaspora that it is not an obligation, that does not mean that you shouldn't want to seize the opportunity to do such a very special thing. In other words, what Joel was saying is, Lama Nigara is missing in many mitzvot performance of our time. Maybe I shouldn't make it in such a blanket way to say that, but he says, Chaval, sadly to say, the people who don't live here are not into the woe unto us that we haven't been able to do this mitzvah, and hopefully someday we will. It's, who cares? It's, no, you're missing the lama nigara, some of you, some of us. And he says very beautifully, it would be nice if our children living in Chutz La'aretz were to hear their parents' sigh of lama nigara, which would at least instill in our children that there is a value in our own time on living in Eretz Yisrael. On that note, I will leave you with one more song, a wish for a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtamea.
Shubeno, Shubeno, Hamed Mishamah.